the relationship between ourselves and Christ in terms of what the Scripture gives us in understandable and more or less absolute terms. I'm not a great friend of the word absolute. I don't know if we have much that we can say absolutely. Absolutes are for God, you know, not for us. We can have truth, relative accuracy, certain facts, but even facts get distorted, you know. We think that facts are irrevocable, or what, after all, is a fact? Just think about it for a minute. So you can say, well, it's a fact that the basis of all our considerations of material matter would be atoms and parts of atoms. Some people would say that is a scientific fact, and I have to say that's a relative fact. You don't know when the whole system is going to be shifted around. You know, it wasn't too long ago that the molecule was the basis of everything. I was in college when they first split the atom, incidentally. The atom, of course, came into focus. I think that was after I was in college. I'm giving you a statement relative to the point that nothing we can depend on as humans as facts, absolutely. These are pragmatic things, functional truth and relative truth. And there's absolute truth. Absolute truth belongs to God, not to us. I remember a young fellow wanted to study Greek with me, and he was sort of from a camp that was very rigid in their beliefs. So I said, well, if you're going to study the Greek Testament, the first thing you got to do is throw out your absolutes and find out what the Testament says. Well, he said, I have to have my absolutes. And I said, well, okay. What do we have to go on as humans on this planet? Now, you have thousands and thousands of systems, not only thousands of interpretations, millions of interpretations. I mean, how many people are there on the earth? Billions. Interpretations of life, interpretations of truth, interpretations of facts. Where do you put your anchor in? And so people say, well, the Bible is our anchor. Fine. What do you think it says? Now, you may think that I've knocked the props out of your basic understanding of things. It's not my intention to knock any props out. It is necessary to find out where we can draw the line and determine what it is that we are doing, what we're supposed to do, what does God think of these things? And what does God convey to us? Many people say, well, I get my revelations from God. I discount that somewhat. Altogether, in fact, I don't know. Maybe they got a revelation from God. Maybe he came in the night and gave them some words. I don't know that. Maybe true. I don't know it. So I don't utterly discount revelation. Only the people who receive it is all I discount. I remember one fellow was debating or discussing with me a particular system of church activity. And I was pointing out the fallacies in the system. And he said, well, the trouble with you is you just haven't received the revelation yet, but that's the truth. Well, I said, thank God for that. Where do we draw the line on that? All right, so we have the Bible. That's the place to start. We've got to start here because that's all we've got. And then how do we know from the Bible whether we are handling the propositions right or not? The human capacity to make propositions or statements is very limited. So if you say God is love, what do you mean by that as a human? What kind of love? We've talked about that quite a bit, but it's worth pulling that together in this context. Love, as the New Testament handles it is divided into several different words, but the word for God's love is agape, which again is propositional if you want to get down to it. But there's a distinction between that kind of love and human affection, and that distinction is that it's a love of interaction, caring, concern, and it is on that basis, as you know, that we can say that we love our enemies. We interact with them. Love almost comes down to a point of interacting with someone. That's the kind of caring we're talking about. Not caring in terms of emotional interaction, but caring in terms of involvement. God cared for us by sending His Son. Christ revealed that love in dying on the cross. All right, there's a basic item that you can pretty well nail down. Christ died on the cross. That's not a matter of interpretation. That's one of those facts. We said facts pretty hard to come by. But there's one point where we can start, that Christ died on the cross as a sacrifice. That sacrifice was relative to the sins of the world. But how do we nail that down? How do we know this? Because of a whole series of ideas in the Old Testament that are actualities of sacrifice. They are the continual, forever symbol of what it means to have the interest of God. So that's why they offered the animals. SPCA would have trouble with it. But fortunately, they didn't make the plan. Anyway, the sacrifice of the Old Testament were realities. I'm not even going to use the word fact because I've just destroyed it, so I can't use it. Realities. The reality of the sacrifice of Christ is a basis for the reality of the Old Testament sacrifices is the basis of our assumptions of God's interest in us. And there were a great number of them. It wasn't just a one-time deal or one kind of sacrifice. It was a number of integral or detailed instructions regarding sacrifice. But we're dealing there with a reality that we can hang on to. The Old Testament sacrificial system. Object lessons that are there. We don't just go for the idea that God made an atonement for us, but we look at the sacrifices and the sprinkling of blood in the tabernacle on the mercy seat. The priest goes in, sprinkles the blood on the mercy seat. That is given to us as an indication of God's interest in us in spite of the failures which may have begun in Eden, but which are not obscure in the world today. Human failure is not an obscure thought. We're surrounded by human failure. Why God doesn't wipe the whole thing out, I don't know. If I were God, I'd wipe the whole thing out, which is probably good for all of us that I'm not God. You look at it and you say, what a mess. The only way to purge this earth is to depopulate it. Wipe the whole thing out. Well, I don't know why he doesn't. But that is an indication to us that in spite of human failure, which is often gross, appalling, whatever, human failure is very, very hard reality in this world. And all the efforts to propositionalize it away are not really all that effective. Well, there are religious groups that use propositions. A proposition, incidentally, is just a statement that one makes about life, and we would call it a hypothesis, presumption. Proposition merely a human philosophical statement, which many books are filled with. In fact, you don't have to worry about whether or not the Vedas, for example, are God's word to us. because it is filled with ethereal propositions that have no substance. You know, it's nice to love everybody and whatnot. And that's true of a great deal of literature that is proposed as revelational. Take the Quran, for example. If anyone in here is a Muslim, I'm not going to pull my punches here. The Quran, for example, which I've read in its original language, is just filled with propositional ideas. You have to assume that the author, which was not really Muhammad, it was Muhammad's ideas that they took, and they call it from Muhammad, but it was his colleagues that actually wrote the Quran. These are all this religious literature is filled with propositional ideas. Now you come to the Bible as a bedrock of truth, as nearly as we humans can understand it. The Bible's a bedrock of truth, but it is a bedrock to us based upon its pragmatic experiences, symbols, allegories that give us a clear picture of what it's all about. And so in the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, you have the actual sample of the requirement of sacrifice. But more than that, the sacrifice indicates to us that God is interested in us in spite of the failures of the human flesh. Of course, in addition to sacrifices of the Old Testament, you have the tabernacle, which was the ultimate symbol of worship or of interaction between humans and God. The Holy of Holies, where the mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant were placed, was a point of contact between man and God at that time. And it was there that the statement is made that the Shekinah glory of God was there. Now, Shekinah is simply a Hebrew word, shakan, that means to dwell. So God met man at the point of the mercy seat. What that indicated was that there was a point of divine caring, and it was real and actual. And one went in there once a year, the priest went in once a year to offer the sacrifice, the blood, on the Day of Atonement. Now, in the New Testament, in Romans 2, it says that Christ is our mercy seat today. The Greek word propitiation, it's translated propitiation, but it really means mercy seat. So, today, the meeting place between ourselves and God is the mercy seat again. But we understand the mercy seat because of the symbolism of the Old Testament. We're not at sea about that. We may be at sea about a lot of things. There's a lot of people struggling across the briny when it comes to prophecy. There was a full two-page spread in the Times about the prophets and their present status with the USSR in shambles and with things that were before rather strongly presented of the timing factor, 70s, 80s, each one had their own group of time factors, all of them down the drain. So now what are they going to do? The burden of the article, what are they going to do now that their prophecies all are out the window? Well, they're going to do what I assumed they would do. They're going to regroup and come at it as though they had been right all along. And, they'll find a way to regroup, and on they'll go. Why should they lose their chief source of support, which was to give people clever statements about the future, as any psychic would, or any gypsy on the midway? Gypsy time is in disrepair right now. These are things that are very much undependable. It is very difficult for us to make absolute statements about those prophetic ideas. But it is not at all out of order to make humanly absolute, not divinely absolute statements about the fact that God is involved with us. You have to start there, that God is involved with us. Little mites on the earth, little microchips. And apart from Christ, without energy. Reality that God involves himself with microchips, which is a vast size, bigger than we really are relative to the world universe, but we'll use that. The absolute reality there is that Jesus was a human on the earth who had the touch of God with him. That God was with Christ, a human on the earth. Therefore, it is not absurd to think that he can be with us, humans on the earth. Otherwise, you know, how often I've said that, how would you have the slightest idea that God is interested in you? Because how would he even see you without a 400 power microscope? Well, you can see a micron size with a 40 power microscope, and he'd have to have a big one to see us. You would say that's what it would have to be. I mean, you know, in reality, if you really understand reality, who are you? I've said, I've given you the analogy that if you put a quarter at the baseboard, that's the size of Earth compared to its own sun. And we're on that little quarter, but relative to the rest of the universe, that's even nothing. Well, they use the expression rugrats. we're rug lint. But it is absurd for us to think that we have some touch with God. But it's not absurd when we see Christ on the earth, a human who came from God, as evidenced by the fact that, well, miracles as such are difficult, but the resurrection from the dead stands as a permanent statement that God himself came to the earth in the person of Jesus and was crucified. In fact, there are those that say, well, Jesus didn't really claim to be God. That was what his disciples claimed for him. Once again, you have an event to nail that down. What is the event? The fact that the Jews crucified him because he made himself God. That was why they crucified him, because he was blaspheming and calling himself God. So he made that statement himself, that he was God. So we have that point. Now we can come to the point that Christ is our mercy seat, and that forgiveness is in the ultimate sacrifice. And that forgiveness is a permanent part of our consciousness, which I will show you in a minute. Because in addition to Christ as the ultimate sacrifice, which is prefigured or typified in the Old Testament, you have the tabernacle itself, a structure in the wilderness. Even the fact that they were able to build it in the wilderness is a marvel. The Egyptians helped them build it. Why? Because they took all their jewelry. The Egyptians were so glad to get rid of them, they unloaded all their jewelry and everything on them to wish them Godspeed. I suppose sometimes you would do that to get rid of somebody. I don't know who to nail it down to, but like the story of the fellow that came to visit his farmer friends, and stayed on. And one morning, the farmer's wife had three eggs for him to eat, along with the breakfast. And he said, oh, you don't need to give me three eggs. One is enough for me. Oh, no, she said, you're going on a long journey today. Well, the Egyptians were so glad to get rid of the children of Israel that they gave them all this stuff. And they used that in building the tabernacle out in the desert. But anyway, be that as it may, it was erected and had its symbolic area. And of course, you have the vast courtyard of the tabernacle where the altar of sacrifice was. Also the laver for washing afterward. But that was your original sacrificial point out in the court. But the main worship center of the tabernacle, or the main object lesson of worship, was the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And even the temples were patterned after that, after the tabernacle in the wilderness. Solomon's temple, Zerubbabel's temple, Herod's temple, all those temples were patterned exactly after the tabernacle in the wilderness. So they all had the same object lesson there. Inside this holy place, which is about, well, it wasn't really much different than the size of this room, although twice as high. You had in there, basically, although in Hebrews 10 there's a little discrepancy about where the altar of incense was, but at any rate, the basic structure was that you had in that room the table of showbread, as it was called, the loaves of presentation, or presents. These were 12 loaves, each represented one of the tribes of Israel. The object lesson of that is Christ, the nourishment of the world, the bread of the world, which we will celebrate today. Now, if you can think of the holy place, the structure in the middle of the courtyard, which was the essence of the tabernacle in the wilderness. Incidentally, a tabernacle is a dwelling place. It is a temporary dwelling place. It's like a tent, and that's what this was, a vast tent. A tent can be very luxurious, as some of those old Arabs on the desert had, very luxurious tents. I think when Paul says he was a tent maker, I don't think we're talking about Boy Scout pup tents. I think he made significant tents. Think of a vast and large tent here, and you've got this main structure. And of course, your mercy seat is in a special place, and I've said that represents the atonement. That represents our connection with God in our spirits. Think of the holy place as a symbol of the spirits, which becomes indwelt by God at the point of the mercy seat, the sacrifice, or the sprinkling of the blood. When we ask for that, we don't have to sprinkle blood, we just have to ask. The very fact that you ask is an indication that the Spirit's working with you, otherwise why would you even think to ask for God in heaven to be in you? You couldn't even think of that. And that's a peculiarity of the Christian religion, or whatever we want to call it. I don't like the terms, but Christianity, or our connection with Christ, is an instantaneous thing when the Spirit touches us. And the peculiarity of it is that you don't have that in other religions. You know, in a Muslim religion, you don't have the Spirit of God touching our spirits. I mean, you don't have that, of course, in Hinduism. You are the Oriental religions, Oriental mystic religions, you have the Great Spirit, we're all spirits, you know, there's an obscure idea of spirits per se, and the so-called afterlife is even more obscure, a nirvana, which is the great eternal nothing. So if you can turn your something life into absolutely nothing, you go into nirvana, I think. So this is peculiar to the Christian religion, to the revelation of God in the Bible. You have variations of interpretation of Christianity, of course, but fundamentally the point is God is wholly other. We're not pantheists. God is not us, and we are not gods. We partake of the divine nature, but we are not little gods running around, contrary to what a lot of people think they are. But a little off base on that, I'll clue you to it. I haven't seen any gods running around myself, even in all of Christendom around the world. I never saw anybody that I said, oh, that must be God. Anyway, that's a peculiarity of Christianity, that God comes to our spirits. And that's the symbolism of the tabernacle, where you have the indwelling presence of Christ, first through the mercy seat, and then through the articles of furniture within the holy place. Incidentally, read the 10th chapter of Hebrews. If you want to find out, read it there. You want a biblical base for what I'm saying. But this is sort of in a way reiterating. We said that years ago, I think, when we were going through our five-year stand in Hebrews. Very important, very important. When you're out there struggling with whether God is there or not. A lot of people struggle with that. Why am I like this? I talked to a woman from a far-off city just this week. so struggling with life because she had some very tragic things that happened. But I won't go into that. You know, I asked her, my first touch with her, I was recommended to her by someone. I said, well, have you got a church connection? No, she said, I don't. She said, as a matter of fact, I'm very angry at God right now. And I said, okay, that's all right. I don't blame you for being angry at him. I might be angry at him too if I had your circumstances. But that doesn't mean he can't be in your spirit, contrary to the constant effort to connect spirit and flesh. It says if you feel angry at God because you've got anger in your spirit, and therefore Christ has obviously taken a powder. He's gone out the back door whilst you vent your anger. That's a very typical idea. Now God is on the throne, now Satan's on the throne, and so forth. They go back and forth, according to some people, although I have to tell you that is merely a hypothesis. There's no basis for that. But be all that it may, the anger was there. And I said, well, you can tie to yourself to Christ in spite of that. You know, be angry if you want to, be my guest. The Spirit of Christ is beyond that. I don't think he's turning blue over the fact that you're angry. But you can work that out. That's something else. But let's just be at peace with Christ. You can be at peace with Christ even though you are not at peace within yourself, you see. So the mercy seat is in that holy place that brings us to Christ, but there are also other articles of furniture that typify our connection with Christ. One of these is the altar of incense. The other is the table of showbread, and the other is the seven-branch lampstand. Table of showbread is the nourishment factor, the loaves that reflect Christ. The lampstand reflects Christ as the light of the world in our spirits. So we have enlightenment in our spirits that we do not always have even in the flesh. The enlightenments in the spirit are there because of the Spirit of Christ within us and not because of any great knowledge of our own. The Spirit of Christ is in us, and with that comes these furnishings which are types of what he does within us. And one of those is the altar of incense, which is the continual flow between our spirits and the Spirit of Christ. There's a continual flow. In spite of the fact that people might have anger or might have problems with their emotions in the flesh, they may not think God loves them. They may think a lot of things. In spite of that human, fleshly, emotional roller coaster, the Spirit of Christ is in us and his light is with us, and his altar of incense in us is the Spirit of Christ constantly in communion with God. In spite of what we may be suffering or struggling with in the flesh. Now, you see, those articles, that whole thing is a symbolism that our minds can get hold of, and our spirits more particularly, without having to struggle with the idea of absolutes or propositions. We can't make statements about God in the same way that we can get object lessons about him. Not the kind of little object lessons we put on in a children's meeting, but the real object lessons of the meaning of God's touch with humanity on the earth. And this is a starting point for us. A starting point of reality. Not even use the word truth. A starting point of reality in the connection that we have with God in this world, on this planet. Even though it says a lot of things I've been saying to you for a long time, sort of nails down something here. It puts a base under you that is not available in other religions. You know, people try to think, well, this is like Christianity and that is like Christianity. These other religions don't have this kind of base, in spite of all the things that they may say.